there's some areas of your life that if you believe you can grow, that you're just much more likely to be able to do the work that allows you to grow. And it's really obvious in our work in human performance that everyone is capable. It's just a matter of finding two things. One is, where is an area where you have innate motivation? And the other is, what are the things that are blocking you? So on the motivation front, most people who look at performance think the whole key is, most like naive kind of takes on performance are that you just need more motivation. Like, people are constantly trying to motivate people.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. If you haven't checked it out yet, our Sunday Quiver is like a behind-the-scenes DVD for the themes of the week's interviews. We recommend articles, links to books written by our guests, TED Talks, and much more. So that way, you don't have to scramble to find all the things that we've referenced during an episode. And when our first book comes out in August, that's where we'll be announcing all the pre-order bonuses. So visit unmistakablecreative.com/newsletter to sign up and to learn more. Today's episode is brought to you by our friends at HostGator. A few episodes ago, I mentioned an article that I read online about the keys to getting hired in the 21st century, and one of those was to have a website. Think about it. There's not a single application that you'll ever fill out that doesn't ask for this. And as I've said before, you need to give people the reason to find you interesting. So consider starting an online project of some sort, even if it's nothing but a simple website with some info about who you are and what's important to you. It can be a really important first step, and our friends at HostGator can help you get started. They have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email, and they'll even stay on the phone with you for 6 hours if that's what's necessary. They have an easy-to-use website builder if you're not tech-savvy, and one-click WordPress installs. And for Unmistakable Creative listeners, they're offering 30% off all their hosting packages. So whether you're looking for a place to showcase your projects or you just need to start a personal brand, HostGator is perfect. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative. Tony, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
You're welcome. I am very excited to be here.
Yeah, it is really, really cool to have you here. You know, I actually came across your story by way of somebody on your team, and I was very intrigued by everything that you're up to. I mean, I think what people probably might know you for is coach.me, which probably many of our listeners actually have installed on their phones if they're trying to change habits. But for the people who don't know about you, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your story, your journey, your background, and how that has led you to everything that you're up to now?
So if we go early in my career, or even early in my life, I think I have a funny answer, which is I got started thinking about human performance by playing Dungeons and Dragons. And the thing that it puts into your head, or at least put into my head, was the idea that your life is constantly about leveling up. And that just, it really stuck with me. And it stuck with me when I playing sports, to play basketball, and I was a distance runner. And it stuck with me when I graduated college. And so I think, you know, some people are really just born ambitious and hardworking. And I almost, in a way, stumbled into it. Because for a long time, even though I had this, like, idea of leveling up in my head, I really actually thought of myself as a pretty lazy, apathetic person. And it wasn't until midway through high school that I realized it wasn't that I was lazy. It was that I just didn't like school. And that was a big epiphany for me, because when I started getting involved in sports, I realized, well, I really love sports. And I often, in the off season, was the person on the team who put the most time into practicing. And so I couldn't be lazy. I had to kind of come to grips with this idea that just because I didn't apply myself to school didn't mean I was lazy. So I, you know, sort of transitioned into thinking I was apathetic about school, but what I really needed to do was find things that I was passionate about. And so later, you know, I found that I was passionate about programming, and I ended up graduating with a computer science degree and getting a job as a programmer working for MasterCard right after the first .com crash. So it was still a point where I could get a reasonably high-paying job. It just wasn't a very interesting job. And that's what really shook me up, is once I started working for MasterCard, I don't know. I think the younger version of me would have been really happy to have a job that had very little pressure and you didn't have to work very hard at. But I think because I had become so passionate about programming that I really hated having a job where I wasn't being challenged, and especially where the work I was doing just really didn't matter. I mean, if you've ever worked in like corporate IT, it's like we just did a lot of really slow moving projects that no one cared that much about. Most of my time at Mastercard, actually, I was played fantasy sports and surfed the web. And, you know, the good news is back then, and this is 2000, the web was a lot smaller, so I actually could read almost all of it. And so that got me hungry, though, because it wasn't a fun job for me. And so I came back out to California, where I grew up, and worked for the most interesting company that would hire me, which was O'Reilly Media, which was a really big tech media company at a point in time when books really still mattered. So in that early 2000s, every programmer had a bookshelf of O'Reilly books literally on their desk. And now I think programmers are more likely to use online resources like Stack Overflow. But there, that period in time, O'Reilly really mattered just tremendously to everyone in tech. And so I stumbled into a very interesting community where O'Reilly was the hub of a ton of people doing interesting work, a ton of open source people, a ton of startup people. And that's where I realized what was actually possible. If I kept leveling up as a programmer, I could, you know, I was starting to see myself as, you know, being part of some hot startup. And that, I think, that's really where my career trajectory started, is because I was connected, and I finally saw the path. I don't know, some people seem to know what their path in life is when they're really young, but I needed someone to show it to me, and O'Reilly is the company that showed it to me. And so what happened after that? Then I got connected to another startup who, I was looking at doing, when I was working at O'Reilly, I was like, well, at the end of the day, this is a book company. And so I do want to work for a real software company. And I got hired to be the head of engineering at a startup called Odeo, which was a podcasting startup. And we actually basically came to the conclusion that podcasting was dead, which this is 2005. And I think it's ironic that, you know, here we are, podcasting was actually very much alive. And so once we realized that podcasting didn't feel like it was going anywhere, we started doing all sorts of side projects and experiments. And very famously, one of those side projects became Twitter. And that's far and away the biggest success that I've, you know, gotten to witness firsthand. So I think I'm the sixth user of Twitter. My family is like the 20th, 21st, 22nd users of Twitter. Like, we were very early adopters. And but still, you know, even that company, I felt like I could do more and have more of an impact on the world. And because more of my experience at that company was not Twitter as we know it now. It was the failures that drove us into Twitter. And so I left to start my own company. That was the first company I ever started. I bootstrapped it, which means we didn't take any investors. And I didn't take any investors. And the company was called Crowdvine. We built social network software and then ended up making a business and conferences. And I think this is, again, it was an awakening around what is my life mission. Because when I went into the company, my mission was really pragmatic: don't fail. And for 3 years, that's what I woke up every day thinking, I do not want this company to fail. And then in year four, it was profitable, and I could say, all right, well, we didn't fail, that's good. But then I had to ask myself, why am I coming to work now that we haven't failed? And I didn't have a reason. that we were building software for conferences, and I couldn't say to myself, I want to be the world's expert in conferences. So that begged the question, what do I want to be the world's expert in? What is it that I would, make my life's work? And on reflection, it went all the way back to Dungeons and Dragons. I've always been interested in what it takes, what is the secret to people that are really elite at their job? And, obviously, I wasn't born just knowing that. So I really was curious about investigating. And so, and I think that's been a trend in everything I've ever been interested in. And so, so that's what led to Coach.me, although Coach.me has its own history of pivots. I think we probably pivoted four times. We're initially called Lyft. We got started with a ton of high-level backers, but unfortunately, no product market fit. And so we had to really, scrap our way to something that worked. And I think now we're at something that works amazingly well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that raises numerous questions, as you might imagine. I actually want to ask you a question about this concept of leveling up and balancing that with a sense of satisfaction with our lives and gratitude for where we're at, because I feel like it can be this never-ending cycle of feeling like we're not where we want to be if all we're doing is constantly thinking about, okay, what is the next level? What is the next level? And I'm curious, especially from your perspective, how you think about something like that.
And, I think that's such an important insight that you're getting at there is, why are you leveling up?
Yeah.
Really early when I was starting this company, I went to a conference that really helped me put my finger on what I liked and didn't like about human performance. This conference was, I think it was just called the Mobile Health Conference. And what it turned out to be was a room full of thin people trying to fix fat people. I mean, that's essentially what it was. Like, oh, obesity, it's so terrible, it's so terrible, it's so terrible. I mean, these thin people were really hurt by overweight people. And I just thought, man, if a fat person was in this room, they would start punching people in the face. I mean, the whole thing was so offensive and so judgmental. And I just thought, that's not what I want to be a part of. I want to be a part of helping people do the things that they really, that are aspirational, and not so much fix themselves, but grow themselves into whoever it is that they want to be. And I think about it, about that world of performance as being about almost two levels of satisfaction. You could have a really great meal. I think probably one of the best meals I ever had is someone treated me to a dinner at Per Se, which is a super fancy restaurant in New York that is probably $400 a person. And I thought that was a fine meal. But I actually don't think about that meal very often. It's not the most satisfying thing that I ever did in my life. But what I do think back to are really hard things that I've accomplished that stretched me. Back when I was a programmer, I wrote a programming book on regular expressions, and it was really hard for me to do. I wasn't qualified at all going into it, and my time management skills for writing a book were terrible. I mean, you must know as an author, it's actually kind of stressful to write a book, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so but I did it, and I'm still proud of it. And so that's the thing that I've come to find is when you really work hard at something, or whenever I've really worked hard at something, that's something that gives me almost a lifelong satisfaction. And so that's how I look at it. Does that make sense? Yeah.
One of the things that's interesting to me is you said at a certain point in your life, you are apathetic, but then you sort of made this mental shift to this desire to level up. I'm wondering if you think everybody has that capacity to do that. And if so, how, how does that happen?
Gosh, absolutely. People do have the capacity. One is just belief. There's actually really good research from this from Carol Dweck at Stanford, who has a whole book on growth mindset, that there's some areas of your life that if you believe you can grow, that you're just much more likely to be able to do the work that allows you to grow. And it's really obvious in our work in human performance that everyone is capable. It's just a matter of finding two things. One is, where is an area where you have innate motivation? And the other is, what are the things that are blocking you? So on the motivation front, most people who look at performance think the whole key is, most like naive kind of takes on performance are that you just need more motivation. Like, people are constantly trying to motivate people. And I have I have a story about someone in my life who's a little bit Asperger-y, who I think perfectly kind of sums up this idea of motivation is, she got on a bus and the bus driver was smoking. And so she said to the bus driver, "Hey, do you know that smoking is bad for you?" Right. And which is a form of motivation, like, "Hey, if you knew that smoking had health risks, would you, you know, don't you think you would quit smoking?" And like, people are constantly trying to tell smokers how bad smoking is for them. But it's not a motivation problem. And this bus driver, you know, just ended up swearing at, you know, saying, you know, "Screw you, you know, I'll smoke if I want to smoke." And because it wasn't a motivation problem. And I think that that's like part of the issue is, I thought I was lazy because I wasn't doing well in school, but I wasn't motivated to do well in school. So that was the core problem. And so you have to do the search for what is it that you are, that you actually like and are interested in. Mm-hmm. And that's how you solve motivation. And then once you have motivation, it's like, you know, what is getting in your way? And so a lot of times people are weighed down by guilt. We have a story from the CoachME community where this guy emailed us to say, "Hey, you know, things are going great. I used you guys to stop eating carbs at lunch and now I lost 10 pounds. And because of that, I'm working on learning Vietnamese and Italian because I might take some time off and travel the world." And I always thought that was such a crazy story, because why on earth would losing 10 pounds be a blocker for traveling the world, right? It just travel the world, dude. You don't have to lose any weight at all. But for him, I think that weight loss was kind of a blocker, where he felt like, well, you know, like he had so much guilt, he couldn't do the things that he really wanted to do. And once he removed that guilt, then it was really easy for him to do something, I think, that was much harder than lose weight, which was, you know, learn a couple languages and make this big life change. Mm.
You know, what I think is interesting is we're talking about intrinsic motivation, and, you know, we live in a world where we are exposed to so much external stimulation and external validation that I think that we actually misperceive what we want to do with our lives and what we want our goals to be, because, like, you can get on Medium every single day and read about some latest unicorn or some, you know, billionaire. And I'm just curious, you know, based on the perspective that you have, having been around the people that you have, especially to have seen, you know, people go on to the success that people like Biz and Jack and all those people have, like, what do you have to say about that?
If I can, I want to reference one of your past guests, Cal Newport, mm-hmm. who, with his work on deep work, he actually gave me a lot of motivation recently to analyze where I was putting my time in terms of social media. And I had this like really eye-opening experience where I wrote something that to my mind was pretty trivial on Medium. It's like I took an answer I'd already given on Quora and kind of fluffed it up a little bit and gave it a link-baity headline. It was like one trick to kill procrastination forever. I think that was the headline. And this thing just took off. It's the like fourth most read post I've ever written on Medium, and it probably took me 15 minutes to publish it. But what was eye-opening is then I think I spent 3 hours, you know, maybe even more than that, over the next 4 days obsessively checking my stats. I was like, I went from being proud of myself for writing something without, you know, taking a ton of time to write it, because I don't have a lot of time to write, and I wish I did, and so I have to be very very sensitive to the scope of writing projects that I take on. So I started out really proud of myself, and then I ended up being kind of ashamed by how addicted I was to the really just recommends and page views. And so so what I did, and this is, you know, I think really articulated well by Cal, was I took all sorts of apps off my phone. I don't have Medium on my phone. I don't have Twitter. I don't have Facebook. I don't, like, no social network that you could think of. And because of that, my phone is really now just a tool for making phone calls, looking at maps, checking my calendar, and, you know, like, calling a, you know, an Uber, or like, I like to order food off of my phone sometimes. But it's just stopped being a time waster. And immediately, I think it maybe took 2 days before the buzzing in my head went away. Mm-hmm. And I was, like, suddenly, you know, much more productive. And it reminded me, when you're talking about, like, people I've worked with who are very productive, a person that I think a lot about is Evan Williams, the mm-hmm. CEO of Medium. And he's on our board, so I actually get a very close look at how he works. And he has this phrase, he actually wrote it on a whiteboard at one of our board meetings once. I don't know why he wrote it on the whiteboard, but I guess it stuck with me, so maybe that was the purpose of it. And the phrase was, there's always another level. And so I think of myself as a very productive person. I've been working in performance for a long time. I'm constantly revising my productivity methods. And yet, this one thing of wiping all these apps off of my phone actually got me to a whole nother level. And I think, we're talking about kind of the feelings around leveling up. Mm-hmm. A common feeling is feeling bad about yourself that you didn't do it sooner. Mm-hmm. And I definitely had that feeling after this one. And I know that feeling comes and then goes, because, I mean, I'd rather be better and just deal with, you know, 15 minutes of feeling bad about myself than, like, stay at the level I am in order to preserve that minor, you know, that minor hurt. Mm.
You know, it's interesting to hear you talk about this. I was just finishing up Chris Hadfield, The Astronaut's book, and he was talking about how it could be really tempting when you're in the position that he's in to basically only be happy and satisfied when you have these huge sort of life accomplishments like going into space. But he realized that what actually made a big difference was to appreciate the really small sort of wins and accomplishments on a day-to-day basis, because those big things don't happen all that often.
Right. So this is something I do that, I think a lot of people are coming to it, but I think this idea of having a gratitude practice mm-hmm. is really important. And the gratitude practice, the first one that I started, I have two, I think they're both really important. But the first one I started was me and my spouse, Sarah, we're in a period of really a lot of high pressure, and things weren't going that well, and we were just super stressed. Like, you know, she was working really hard and getting her MBA, and I was getting my first company off the ground, and it was just hard to even make payroll, you know? And so that was a very stressful time. And so we started something that we called Two Good Things. And I guess now we're 9 or 10 years into it, where every night we each tell each other two good things from our day. And what that does, for me at least, is really kills the idea that my life is like hard or bad. Like, I have never had a bad day where I couldn't, you know, didn't have at least two good things that happened to me. And sometimes a good thing is like I ate a really good burrito. Mm. I mean, that definitely, we've had periods of like what we ate was the best thing that happened to us. But a lot of times they're really amazing. And I think that kind of keeps a baseline level of gratitude going for me, so I never go too far into a dark place. And then the other thing that I do is a yearly review, where I try and come up with one major highlight for every week since the last time I did the review. So I'm like basically yearly on these and come up with about, you know, 50 plus of these every time I do it. And what I love about that is that if you were asking me to, like, just off the top of my head, summarize the last 12 months, I would say I worked really hard and work was stressful, right? And then, but when I look at the list, I'm like, wow, you know, I saw great movies, I read great books, I traveled to great places, I made great friends, and I had really huge work accomplishments that I'm very proud of. And so now that list, which I publish every year, now I can go back and say, well, look, the things I was accomplishing the first year I wrote this list are nothing compared to what I accomplish now. Like, my life is great. And I think that really helps me stay balanced in what would otherwise be, you know, I think, a pretty tough job. I think the job of a CEO is always hard. Mm-hmm. I think it's especially hard at the beginning of a business when, like, nothing works. Like, you don't know who nothing works. Your product, you know, isn't there. The quality is not there. You don't know who your customers are. You don't know where money is going to come from. It's just, there's a lot of uncertainty. And the gratitude practice for me is one of the best. And actually, in the Coach.me community, there's a couple of major gratitude sub-communities. One, write three good things about your day is one of the top ones. And it's just a really beautiful practice that I would recommend for almost anyone.
There's more of my conversation with Tony after this message from our sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you by TrueCar. Pricing information is great and necessary, but there's more to car buying than just price. There's the actual buying experience, and to enjoy a better one, you have to go to a TrueCar certified dealer. They're there to help you find the car you want, and they're what make TrueCar unique. With TrueCar, you can connect with a local certified dealer of your choosing, so you can lock in guaranteed savings off MSRP and enjoy a better car buying experience. TrueCar customers are more likely to enjoy a faster buying process when they connect with TrueCar certified dealers. Over 2 million cars have been sold to TrueCar users by the TrueCar certified dealer network, and there are 11,000 certified dealers nationwide. You'll work directly with a TrueCar certified dealer contract, and TrueCar users save an average of $3,279 off MSRP. So when you're ready to buy a new or used car, visit TrueCar.com and download the TrueCar app to enjoy a better car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states. At the beginning of the episode, I talked about why you need to give people a reason to find you interesting. The world is getting noisier, and we're no longer rewarded for fitting in, but for standing out. So consider starting an online project of some sort. Even if it's nothing but a simple website with some info about who you are and what's important to you, it can be a really important first step, and our friends at HostGator can help you get started. They have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email, a website builder that's super easy to use, and one-click WordPress installs. And for Unmistakable Creative listeners, they're offering 30% off all their hosting packages. So whether you're looking for a place to showcase your projects or you just need a personal brand, HostGator is perfect. Visit hostgator.com/creative and use the promo code creative. And remember, when you support our sponsors, you support our show. Now back to my conversation with Tony.
You mentioned that when you were at O'Reilly, and up until that point, you couldn't really see it, but at that point, you kind of saw the path that your career would take. And I want to ask this in a different way than I've asked in the past. Let's say somebody is at a moment where they don't feel like they've seen the path. Are there ways they can look for it in their existing environment?
Yeah, So I've seen people go at it two ways, but only one of those ways appears to work. One is to do nothing until you know what the path is. So there's like, you analyze, you do exercises, you do a lot of self-examination. And what ends up happening is that no idea that you come up with actually ends up feeling strong enough to you that you could say, yes, this is my path. The approach that I do see work is actually the opposite of that, is you go out and you try things and you experiment and you like go aggressively trying to do great work. And at some point you learn what works and what doesn't work. And there's a kind of a quote that explains that, that I got from Eric Ries, the author of Lean Startup, which I've never heard him say this publicly, but he said it to me privately, and I really loved the quote, which is, a startup is the process by which the founders come to understand themselves. And I just thought that was such a great observation, that your path in life is not something that you come to intellectually. It's something that you feel all the way, you know, to your core. And so you can't actually know it. You can only know it through experience. When you experience it, you'll say, oh, That is it. And so you see this in entrepreneurs where it's like, you don't make decisions in your company based on what is the best, best possible outcome. You're constantly filtering it based on what are you interested in doing. Otherwise, we'd all be running like hedge funds or something. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, by default, we've done major filtering just, before day one. And so that's what I see mostly is you have to come at it from experience. And so the best thing you can do is really try a lot of things.
Do you think everybody has a path that they're destined to take?
I don't know. Do you? That's a good question. I hope so. I hope there's what I hope for is that people have acceptance. So what I think of as the most sad question that I ever read, but also one that I kind of gives me a chuckle is if you see someone ask. And you often see this question on like Hacker News. If you'll see someone ask like, I'm 27 and I've never started a company. Mark Zuckerberg was worth X billion dollars at this age. Is my life over?
Right? I'm 38, so I have to laugh.
Right. That. I know exactly. Right. I think I was 27 or 28 when I started my first company. I was Jack Dorsey's boss. And he actually had started a company when he was really young. I think it was a courier company, but the companies that mattered, he didn't start those until he was Twitter. I think he was 28 when he started, and Square, he would have been 32. So there's plenty of time, and if you actually look at it, you can find people who didn't start their first real company until their 40s or 50s. So you're never really behind. But more about that question, I think why. Why is your definition of what you should be based on Mark Zuckerberg? I mean, when I think about acceptance, it's, I had a ton of great coworkers at MasterCard who seemed completely fine with that otherwise pretty boring work. And the reason they were fine is because they knew their life mission was not defined by work. It was defined by family and friends. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. I think the important thing is to know what feels right to you. And if, in a way, family and friends seems way healthier than entrepreneurship. I didn't choose entrepreneurship because I think there's something intrinsically better about it. I just happen to know myself that it's more like a compulsion.
It's interesting, and I really appreciate that perspective because I think that we live in a culture that perpetuates and glamorizes the entire concept of entrepreneurship, lifestyle. What do? I bring on people like you to talk about the work that they do all day long. And I realize at a certain point, like, when I, even in my own media consumption patterns, I noticed reading a lot of this is making me feel a lot less accomplished and a lot, like I'm not worth much because I keep being, setting a standard that's impossible to measure up to.
Right. I think we're talking about performance a little bit, but we're like, yeah. We're talking about a gratitude practice, right? Mm-hmm. So I think, I think there's always multiple levels that you have to tackle performance at. And, kind of the more unique things to talk about are the things on the edges, right? Like, I basically feel like the keys to my performance are meditation and gratitude. Mm-hmm. Even though, like, the head-on keys to my performance are, like, product sense, marketing, sales, right? Like, those things are actually what makes me a better CEO and makes CoachMe a more successful company, but those things never would have worked. I never would have been able to stick with it if I hadn't done these things on the edges. And of course, whatever your like core competency is, it's very natural for you to put work into it. And I think that's not usually the thing that's tripping people up.
Well, there's no way I'm going to let you out of this conversation without talking about the early days of Twitter and Odeo. I mean, getting to work with people like Ev Williams, you know, Biz Stone, Jack Dorsey, I mean, who effectively at this point, you know, we look at as sort of Silicon Valley folk heroes. What did you learn from them about success, about human behavior, about psychology, about human performance, from being up and so close to people that are really kind of visionary thinkers?
A ton of good lessons from all of them. And so I'll start with Biz. He has this phrase that I think really like summarizes the whole, almost everything I think about human performance is, he says, it took him 10 years to become an overnight success. Mm-hmm. And I like that humility of it, of just, he knows he put the work in, and that tons of people are treating him like, you know, wow, you just came up with Twitter. It's amazing, right? And it's like, well, he put a lot of work into putting himself in a position where something like that could happen to him. Obviously, there's luck involved, but, you know, tons of people I talk to are trying to skip the hard work. Like, even when I think about Coach on Me, there's two ways I could tell you how I raised, you know, money for it the first time. The kind of the way that people talk about how they raise money is often like makes it seem trivial. Like, I had this great idea and then I told someone about it and they gave me money, right? And that's actually what happened. Is I had a coffee with Ev, and he actually had tea and I had milk and cookie actually. But so we got together for a meeting. I didn't demo anything. I just told him the idea and he said, "That is amazing. I would love to work on this with you. Let me invest and I'll like co-design the first version with you." And so it was just based off of a coffee. But the better thing, and this is where I think the Biz quote comes into play, is to ask, well, how did I get that coffee with Ev? And for me, it started with, I taught myself how to code, and then I went to college and I got a computer science degree. And then I worked as a programmer, even writing a book on programming. And that helped me get a job where I actually ended up working for Evan Williams, did a great job as his head of engineering, and kept in touch with him until this point later in his life where he had free time and, you know, obviously enough money to be an investor. So that whole process took me 15 years. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Basically, from when I first started writing code to that coffee with Ev was a 15-year process. And tons of people think, well, that they can be an entrepreneur. Like, they're bringing not even one deep skill to it, but somehow they think they can start a company. And yeah, I mean, maybe that's true, but it wouldn't hurt to also be good at, you know, good at some part of your work and to have some experience. Mm-hmm. The thing though that I also often think about with Ev and Jack is that they're not traditional CEOs as you hear about in the press, right? They're not Donald Trump. They're not Larry Ellison. They're not a particular form of Steve Jobs. They're both very much design visionaries. But Steve Jobs, if you read that autobiography, he was really kind of a jerk, right? And I think there's this mythology around CEOs as people who are like really hard-charging, making aggressive decisions. And they both showed a path around reaching success by making a few very high quality decisions. And Ev has done this, I think, three times in a row with Blogger and then Twitter and then Medium, that he knew what to focus on and he kept the companies focused on those things. And he didn't do it through yelling and screaming. And so I don't meet the Larry Ellison test. I'm just not that type of person. Mm-hmm. And so if you had to be that type of person to be a CEO, then I could never be a CEO. And I think that if I hadn't met Jack and Ev, I wouldn't have known what that other pattern looks like.
Do you think that everybody has the capacity to perform at the level that people like Ev and Jack and Biz do? Like, do you think that is inherent in every one of us?
Right. There's that book, Talent is Overrated.
Yep. I've had Jeff Colvin here as a guest before.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I think that is the reality of it. You got to balance that with the Warren Buffett quote that he won the genetic lottery, mm-hmm. which is essentially he had good parents, right? Like, he's not, if you're, you know, he was free from baggage.
Yeah.
And I think that's the major caveat, is you have to be, it's helpful to be free from baggage. There is such a thing as baggage, and that does hold people back. And so you shouldn't be judging other people. But when you're just thinking about yourself, yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, Jack wasn't born Jack. I mean, Jack, when I knew him, was just a very reliable engineer. He wasn't a CEO. He wasn't a visionary. He wasn't raising his hand in product meetings with, you know, bold proclamations about what we could build. He wrote code, and he wrote it really well. And even when you think about the first time he was Twitter CEO and then how he was as Square CEO, everyone that I've talked to said that there was a huge improvement in how he ran a company. And so what that tells you is that all of these people grew into it. The same, you know, I don't know all of Ev's history, but, you know, I mentioned three companies that he started, but I didn't mention the fourth, and he might have started more, but my understanding is that he was running some sort of CD-ROM-based multimedia company out of Nebraska. And I don't know the details, but what I heard is that it did not end well. And so if you think about it, it's like, well, Ev wasn't born Ev. He started a company and did a really bad job at it. And then he started another company and did a better job at it, and it was more successful, and that was Blogger. And he started Twitter, and I think did an even better job of running Twitter than Blogger. And he started Medium, and I think Medium is far and away the best-run company that he has started. And so, that's just proof that he got there through hard work. And, you know, among the many things that we idolize in the Valley, you know, Google idolizes college degrees and, you know, SAT scores and whatnot. I have no idea what Ev's SAT scores are. Mm-hmm. But he has three semesters at Nebraska. I mean, even if you had a PhD from Nebraska, would Google hire you? Like, I think probably not, actually, right?
Right.
And so, you know, I watch Ev and he works hard. And that's like, that's really a lot of it. He works hard not just on getting the work done, but on improving himself. And so, if that's what you want to sign up for, is, you know, 5 to 10 years of improving yourself, you can make really miraculous changes in your life. And even, you know, even a week of improving yourself usually have a pretty massive immediate impact.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate that you talk about the 5 to 10 year perspective, because I think our perception of longevity is kind of warped.
Yes.
You know, given what we see. I mean, I, like, you know, you and I were talking earlier that I'm getting to be an author, and I think it's been 7 years before I got to do that.
Right.
You know, and that entire process, I realized it was a process of reinvention. Somebody told me once, I think it was James Altucher, he said reinvention is a 5-year process at a minimum.
That's great. So that sort of begs the question of, well, is that a turn on or a turn off? Mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of people peddle instant results. Even we, to some degree, do frame a lot of our work in a way that implies instant results. So when we were doing, you know, kind of designing our products, there's an underlying behavior design methodology, which we based initially off of BJ Fogg's work, who's a professor at Stanford, and his methodology is called Tiny Habits. And when we kind of worked it into coaching, we called it momentum. And so we always... The thing that works for our clients the best is if we start with something small. There's no, we're going to do this whole thing overnight. We're going to start with something small and build consistency and build momentum from that, almost like rolling a snowball downhill. You don't have to start with a big snowball, because it'll get big by the end of the hill. And so that is important, that you do get immediate results, because otherwise you won't ever stick with it for the whole 5 to 10 years, or I even like hesitate to say 5 years. I'm thinking about when I made the transition from engineer to manager, it probably took me a year to like really wrap my head around it. But most people, when they think about, you know, like, I want to be a better manager, can you explain how in 2 to 3 sentences? Right, like, that's the mindset that just really doesn't work.
Yeah, the soundbite culture.
Right. what's the trick to being a better manager? I was like, oh my God. You're going to have to read at least a book.
Yeah. I would say so. It's kind of the same question I get asked about writing. How do you write so much? I'm like, you sit down and you write every day.
Right. You know, there is, I don't do a ton of the coaching at Coach.me, but I often will coach early on as we're kind of, whenever we're putting out a new program, usually I'm the leading edge of that, of test out coaching methodologies. And I had this one client early on who was trying to write their dissertation and really struggling. And what he said to me, he said, Tony, like, all I want to be able to do is write for 8 hours a day, but I keep procrastinating. And I don't like to just flat out argue with my clients. I mean, you know, obviously the thought in my head is nobody can write for 8 hours a day. That's the most ridiculous goal I've ever heard. Yeah. Instead, what I let them come to a different epiphany, which is I gave them a very simple, and this is an example of a momentum-based framing, is I said, that's great. We'll get to that. But just as a starting point, could I give you a challenge? I want you to get a stopwatch, and the next time you, tomorrow when you go to your desk, I want you to time yourself. How long does it take you from when you first sat down to completing your first sentence? And so he responded right away saying, or the next day he said, hey, that actually really worked. It took me a minute and 37 seconds to write my first sentence. And that just that got me unblocked. I wrote a ton over the next 2 hours. And now I think, you know, honestly, all I really need to do is write for 2 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, that's the, that epiphany for him, I just thought was really so valuable that, you do what is the secret is just to do it. And people are jumping all the way to some fantasy in their head. Like he thought, well, the secret is to write for 8 full hours a day. And it's like, well, no, I mean, the secret is to write the first sentence and then don't stop.
Yeah. It's a bit like putting your shoes on or going to the gym. It's like, well, you're already here. You might as well work out.
Exactly. Right. Those things really matter. And, you know, on the writing front, an example I like to give is Stephen King, super prolific writer. Yeah. And if you read his autobiography, he describes his productivity method as he sits down at 8 a.m., and he's got a word count that he's shooting for, maybe a page count, something, basically reasonable, say for him at least 10 pages a day. But that's not what was really fascinating to me. What I latched onto was the tail end of the story where he said, usually I finish around 4 p.m. Sometimes I finish as early as 1. And so here, I'm in startup culture and people are like, oh, you should be working, all the time, all the way till midnight. And here is, here's one of the most prolific writers of all time saying, no. All you have to do is just do it consistently. Mm-hmm. He's not saying, I knocked this book out by, writing until 2 a.m. every night. I mean, he has if his description of his life is, sounds really pleasant. Right.
Yeah.
I wish I was done with my work at 4 p.m. every day. I mean, maybe that might actually be healthier. It's something I've considered.
Yeah. I can't help but ask you, being around people Ev Williams, Biz Stone, and Jack Dorsey, and seeing, them amass significant amounts of wealth, what your perspective on money and wealth is has been as a result of being in that environment? How has it changed or has it? What do you see as patterns in this?
That is a good question. That is, I'm just trying to think about how personal of an answer I can give to this, because that actually cuts, very deep, I think, for a lot of people who were early at Twitter, because not everyone at Odeo ended up owning Twitter stock.
I know. I read Hatching Twitter and I was kind of shocked by some of it.
Right. And, it's because Twitter wasn't worth anything and Ev bought the whole thing back. Uh-huh. And no one put up any sort of fight around that because we didn't see any real value to it. And to be honest, I don't really feel bad because I ended up not owning stock because I ended up leaving. I basically helped pick the team that would stay with Jack and then didn't see a role for myself, so I went and did something else. And I don't think I did anything really tremendous. I mean, that's part of the Hatching Twitter story, is there's all these people that think that because they were in the room when Twitter came about, that they somehow played a big role. But actually, having watched Twitter get built, I think the people that played a big role were the people who stuck it out, that had to go through all those sleepless nights and really had to find an audience for Twitter. I mean, Twitter was maybe 200 users when I left, right? Like, Biz did something amazing to get Twitter into the cable news ecosystem. So there, I think one thing that helped give me perspective was just starting a company and realizing how much more work there is than just the idea. I mean, the idea really is meaningless. It's the execution and all of the headache that goes along with that. The other thing I realized, and this is more watching Friends, and this is not really about Ev, Jack, or Biz, but it's about other people who were at Twitter, is I didn't really feel like Twitter made them happy. And I think that, I mean, obviously I'm not saying anything surprising, that money does not, if you have some hole in your soul, right, if you have some deep thing that is causing you unhappiness, money is not the thing that's going to solve that. In fact, it's going to exacerbate it. I'm not the first person to say that, but there is something about that phrase, money, you know, doesn't buy you happiness. That is a life lesson that everyone insists on learning for themselves, right? Like, you know, it's like, it sounds right, but I'd rather have money and know for sure.
Yeah.
So I don't push that very hard, but I definitely, that was an observation from me. And, you know, same too, there was a lot of clamoring for credit. And I think credit doesn't at the end of the day give you satisfaction. Mm-hmm. Because these are all external things, and they're not going to solve whatever internal problems you're having. So that's what I noticed with it. I think out of all of the people involved with Twitter, I really feel like Ev came out of it the most whole, because he went into it, you know, really whole. Like, he was an established person. I mean, certainly Twitter changed his wealth, but he was already, you know, very wealthy from the blogger days. And so, you know, and also I say that because I know Ev the best, and I think he is a great example of what a person could be and could do with their life. I mean, great family man, very accomplished in business, but, you know, doing business the right way, in a way that is world positive and puts his money to use doing world positive things, and has good friends and is healthy, takes care of his mental and physical health, you know, is a big meditator. I actually am in a meditation circle with him sometimes. And, you know, I think he's a great example, certainly someone that I look up to, that managed to do that whole journey in a really healthy way.
Hmm. Well, this has been awesome. And just a really, really cool conversation. And I really appreciate you taking the time to join us. So I have one last question for you, which I know you've heard me ask. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
That is a good question. It is, you know, it's intrinsic motivation. That, like, it, I think that's what it all boils down to. Like, people who are unmistakable choose a path. I mean, certainly they take external inputs, but I think they're really driven by some internal vision of what they could accomplish in the world. And that is so, it's so easy in a lot of ways. I mean, it's just do what's in your heart, but also so hard and so rare. So that's what I always look for in people. People that can work from their heart, from their soul. I think a book that really helped me in that regard is a leadership book, True North. And it's so rare, and I don't understand why that should be. And so I just try to, give people confidence that they can, pursue, you know, they can bet on themselves, basically.
Well, this has been really cool. I have just enjoyed talking to you so much, and I really, really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share your story and your insights with our listeners.
All right, Srini, thank you.
Yeah, and for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Next time on The Unmistakable Creative.
So everybody who was playing a key role in my life, I had a chance to really step back, look at this period of time, a few years at a time, look at these questions. What did I receive from this person? What did I give to them? And what troubles and difficulties did I cause? and over the course of 2 weeks, I had a chance to really construct a film of how I had lived my life from as far back as I could remember up until the present day. It wasn't kind of a smooth film like what you know, watch when you go to the movie theaters. It was very choppy, but it had very discrete little video segments of incidents and encounters and joy and sadness. And ultimately, that became my the story that I left that center with.
Greg Kretsch from the To-Do Institute joins us to talk about the Japanese art of self-reflection.